Okay, so let's start with an objection which is often raised by skeptics, which is that everything we've been talking about so far fits into this rubric which could be called the God of the Gaps fallacy. You heard this before? So you could say, well, I think that there's a good reason to believe that the universe came into existence and things don't just pop into existence out of nothing, but there needs to be a cause behind it. If there's a cause, it has to have certain properties, and those properties identify with what we would call God. Or the universe is finely tuned, and the laws and the initial conditions and the constants are finely tuned, and any being which could finely tune the laws within the universe would need to exist transcendent of the universe. Or the origin of life, or the origin of whatever. You could make an argument from science, but skeptics would say, you're just appealing to the God of the gaps. When you give these quote-unquote scientific arguments for the existence of God, what you're really doing is just making statements of ignorance, not statements of evidence. So when you claim, well, here's a really good argument, how could you explain this? They're saying, well, you're just pleading ignorance. It's an argument from ignorance. Here's Peter Boghossian. He's an atheistic philosopher. This is from his recent book. I guess it's not that recent. It seemed a lot more recent when I read it, but 2013. It's called A Manual for Creating Atheists. He says that the God of the Gaps argument is the believer's appeal to God as an explanation for whatever phenomenon we cannot explain scientifically. For example, if the scientific understanding of the day cannot explain lightning bolts, the believer will say, God did it. Once we can scientifically explain the mechanism behind lightning, the believer will move on to another phenomenon and attribute God as the cause of that phenomenon. Before we critique this, let's just make sure we're grasping it, and let's even ask the question, is there something that we can affirm in what he's saying? Do you think there's some truth to what Boghossian is arguing? What do you think? You claim that God exists and it's because we can't understand it. That's what the Greeks said and they thought it was Zeus. Turns out it was electricity, atmospheric pressure. What do you think? Is there some truth to it? There's the famous example of Isaac Newton, who is an avid, ardent Bible believer. And he said that the elliptical and the orbits of the planets, you couldn't explain that without believing in a divine mind. Then we look back now and we're like, oh, well, kind of, you could. It's gravity. It's a force that could easily explain it. You don't need an extra cause behind it. Yeah. Sure, but they would push it back a step and say, well, yeah, maybe the existence of lightning and the orbits, those are dependent on fine-tuning, and you need a God for that until we find out the cause behind that too. What do you think? My parking ticket didn't go through. Hallelujah. It must have been Jesus. It's good. Okay. I think there's some truth to it. I think this should make us cautious. That's for sure. Into just saying, well, God did it. Something we can't explain. It's anti-scientific for one, just to say, well, I can't explain it, therefore God did it. You see this happen with people too, where they look out at the sky and they say, wow, those stars, star formation, they've clustered together. That must have been God. We can explain that. That's not God. I mean, God set up the conditions, but it's not as though he just popped a bunch of stars into place like Fantasia. There are certain forces at work. What would our critique be? First is that atheists or skeptics also give non-empirical explanations of scientific phenomena. What do I mean by that? Well, I'll give you an example. They say, we can't explain fine-tuning. There's all these constants, all these initial conditions, astronomically precise or infinitesimally precise, depending on which way you look at it. And they give this argument called the anthropic principle. It goes like this. If the improbabilities of fine-tuning for a life-permitting universe didn't occur, then we wouldn't be alive to be surprised about it. So let's think about that for a second. Is that true? If the gravitational constant was off just a little bit and there were no rocky planets, would you be here reading your graduate level physics textbook to be shocked by this discovery? No, you wouldn't. So there's some truth to it. But before we even critique this, you see my point so far. Is this a scientific explanation? No, it's a philosophical explanation. They don't have a scientific answer, so they've punted to a non-empirical explanation. Well, the critique of this has been pretty devastating. John Leslie, who's a philosopher, gives the illustration that you are put up in front of a firing squad of, let's say, 100 marksmen, and they're 15 feet away. You get taken out there, and you get a blindfold around your eyes, and your hands are tied behind your back. And just then you hear the commander of the guard say, "Ready, men, aim, fire!" And you hear, you know, the roar of guns. You hear 100 rifles go off. And then all of a sudden, you take the blindfold off, you look down, all of them missed. You look behind yourself at the wall, and there is a silhouette of you in gunshots around the wall. So you're in shock. They take you back to the barracks with the other prisoners of war. And you're pacing back and forth in front of your bunk bed and in front of your roommate. You're saying, "Oh my God, what happened? Was that a miracle? Was it our comrades? They came in and they filled all their guns with blanks? Now that wouldn't explain it. There was a silhouette of the bullets. Was it that they all missed on purpose just so that they would see me urinate my pants? Were they playing a game with me? And all of a sudden you're trying to explain this improbability. And your roommate says to you, "If the improbable didn't happen, then you wouldn't be alive to be surprised about it." You're saying this is such a big, incredible thing that needs an explanation. But hey, pal, if one of them didn't miss, you wouldn't be surprised to sit here and talk about what the explanation was. So Leslie accurately parodies this argument with this illustration. The skeptic is saying, well, if the fine-tuning didn't occur, we wouldn't be here. That's true. But because it did occur, does that mean that we should cease being surprised or try and create an explanation for it? Well, absolutely not. To put that in perspective, could you go to sleep that night? Is that prisoner of war with that explanation? Hey, pal, if one of them shot you in the heart, you wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. So go to sleep and stop keeping me up all night. No, you'd be up all night trying to figure out what happened. Furthermore, if this explains away this improbability, then it explains away every improbability. Well, how does that work? Imagine you're sitting there with your buddy and you're playing poker for $1,000 a hand. And he gets 4 aces 10 times in a row. When you get up to pull out your gun and shoot him, or at least punch him in the jaw, he says, "Whoa, whoa, 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 dude. If I hadn't gotten 4 aces in a row, 10 times in a row, you wouldn't be surprised about it." That's true. If you hadn't gotten those cards, I wouldn't be surprised about it. But the very fact is that you did get those cards, and gosh darn it, I am surprised about it. Something needs to explain that. Well, not only is the anthropic principle flawed, as I'm pointing out here, it doesn't explain, or it is a non-empirical philosophical explanation. Naturalists will say, well, we can explain the fine-tuning, but what if we don't live in a universe, one verse, like a unicycle, one cycle, but instead we live in a multiverse? This is also called the world ensemble theory, or multiple universe theory. So let's go back to John Leslie's illustration of you get tied up in front of the 100 trained marksmen. Imagine you hear, "Ready, aim, fire," the barrage of guns, and then you're still alive, but then you take off your blindfold and you look around and you realize that there was 100 other people being executed at the same time and 99 of them are dead. Would you be as shocked then? The same thing is true at the multiverse. You might say, well, we hit the jackpot and it's infinitesimally difficult to explain how one universe could have those conditions, But what if there are trillions and trillions, if not an infinite number of universes out there? Then it would make sense that one of them did hit the jackpot. Well, I've already given you the chapter which refutes this. I guess I'll just read this section from George Ellis, who is an eminent cosmologist. He comes from South Africa, fought apartheid. He's a Christian, as far as I can tell, but I'm telling you, he's in the top five in the world on this. He wrote this article in Scientific American. It was called, Does the Multiverse Really Exist? Ellis says this, if the multiverse exists, it leaves the deep mysteries of nature unexplained. All the parallel universes lie outside our horizon and remain beyond our capacity to see, now or ever, no matter how technology evolves. So, you can see what he's saying there. Either you believe that these universes exist in different dimensions, that's one model for the multiverse, or you believe that these are actually physical bubbles of universes which has spawned off of our universe, and there's just, you know, a seemingly infinite space in between. So we can't connect with those other universes out there. Either way, you can't connect with them if they're in a different dimension, and you can't connect with them if they're way out beyond the speed of light. There's no way we could ever detect these, now or ever, he says. In fact, says Ellis, they are too far away to have had any influence on our universe whatsoever. That is why none of the claims made by multiverse enthusiasts can be directly substantiated. We have no hope of testing it observationally. So let's think about that statement. We have no hope, even in principle, of observing and testing this claim. What would you consider that? That would be considered a non-empirical explanation. Is the multiverse, in other words, a scientific explanation, or is it a philosophical explanation? Surely it's the latter and not the former. Third, directed or undirected panspermia. I don't want to overstep myself. I don't think it was originated by Francis Crick. He was the one who worked on the genome, the DNA double helix, Crick and Watson. Very respected microbiologist. As he was starting to study the human genome over the decades, he came out back in the 70s with this theory that it was called directed panspermia. Undirected panspermia would be that the origin of life came on like a meteor, the amino acids, the maybe even some simple cells, traveled across the universe, crashed into the planet, and then the origin of life began. That'd be undirected. Directed panspermia is the thought that aliens came. This would be like that movie, the prequel to Alien. What's it called? Prometheus. It'd be like Prometheus. They come, they seed our planet with life, and then life gets takes off that way. Interestingly enough, Richard Dawkins also agrees with this view. When you start to look at the human genome, how do we explain it? We're no closer to understanding the origin of life than ever before. We're no closer. I mean, I'm not saying we haven't studied it more, not that there's more theories. There are, definitely. But there's no explanation for it, even as we've studied it. Here's Richard Dawkins in his interview with Ben Stein. This is from the movie Expelled.
Well, then who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it got started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, how did that happen?
I told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. Mm. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology. You might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable, or ultimately explicable, process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God.
We can appeal to non-empirical explanations all day long as you don't say the G word. As soon as you say God, oh, that's utterly ridiculous. So you're going to say there are an infinite number of invisible universes surrounding us. That makes sense, but one God doesn't. Or you're going to say that little green men traveled to our planet and seeded life on our planet. What's the evidence for this? There is none. If you were to put this in a really short, concise way, is that if somebody says, well, that's just the God of the gaps, how do you know it isn't just naturalism of the gaps? Or how do you know it isn't just little green men of the gaps? Or infinite invisible universes of the gaps? Can't we just, doesn't the sword cut both ways? Moreover, some gaps have actually been opening and not closing over time. Some gaps have been opening, not closing, which really does give a different picture. The skeptic's claim here is that given enough time, given enough study, given enough graduate students, given enough experimentation, we'll find the answer. Here's the thing. In many of these fields, which we're appealing to here, scientific experimentation and scientific exploration has grown, but scientific explanations have shrunk. Scientific experimentation has increased, scientific explanations have decreased. So, for example, in cosmology, the origin of the universe, we are learning more and more and more, but the big lacuna in the room is that how do we explain this? Where did it come from? How do you have a space-time beginning of the material universe? Excuse me. We can't base our views on what might hypothetically occur in the future, but instead what has actually been discovered. That's consistent. Richard Dawkins, if you asked him, is it hypothetical that we could find out that neo-Darwinism is a complete lie? Is that hypothetically possible? Richard Dawkins would say, yeah, that's hypothetically possible. We could find a fossil that's in the wrong strata. We could find human beings back with the dinosaurs. We could eventually dig and find and disprove Darwinism. That's hypothetically possible. So what if we said to him, well, because it's hypothetically possible that Darwinism could be overturned, therefore we shouldn't believe it. We have to build our convictions. We have to use our reason based on what we have discovered. Let me give you a couple of examples of this principle in play. Imagine if you're in court and the lawyer says something like this. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I know that my client looks guilty, but hypothetically, we could discover more evidence in the future that he's not guilty. In fact, this has happened in numerous other court cases. Therefore, we should be perpetually agnostic with regard to guilt and or innocence. Is that true? Have there been other cases where somebody looks very, 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 very guilty and the evidence is piling up, and yet it turns out later that we discover fingerprint evidence, or an alibi, or genetic evidence, DNA evidence that acquits the person? Is that true? Are there some cases of that? Yes, that's true. Of course that's true. That's happened in some cases. But because it's happened in some cases, does that mean we should apply it to all cases? No, of course not. We can't go on what we don't know. We have to go on what we do know, what we have discovered. Imagine if a Christian said, someday we could hypothetically discover good evidence that God exists. Therefore, you shouldn't be an atheist. I actually used this at a CT one time. Somebody got up afterward for the Q&A and they got their microphone and they said, well, what happens in the future if we eventually find out that the universe does have a material cause and there was something that happened before the Big Bang, and eventually scientists discover that material natural causes fill that gap? What would you say then? And I said this. I said, what if I came out here tonight to give a persuasive talk on why God exists? And I said, you know, hypothetically in the future, scientists could discover that there's really good evidence for God. Therefore, you should become a Christian. You would rightly laugh me off the little stage. I say little, I mean it, 8 inches tall. You would laugh at me if I said such a thing. Such a thing would be absurd. That's exactly what the claim is here. That hypothetically this could be disproven. We can't go on what's hypothetically possible, but what has actually been discovered. What we're seeing here is that this approach rules out theism definitionally. It doesn't rule it out evidentially. In other words, they're stacking the deck in their favor because they're creating the definition. So sometimes you'll hear people say something like this. I know that you're making all of these scientific arguments and we can't explain this or that, but here's the thing. Science and God are mutually exclusive. Science, the whole endeavor of science is that it only observes and measures natural causes, not supernatural ones. Therefore, science can never offer evidence for God. In and of itself, that would make sense, but you know what they call this in philosophy? They call this a tautology. It's where you're including the conclusion in the premise, but the premise itself isn't justified. Let me put that a different way. Who made that rule? Science only observes and measures natural causes. Who made that rule? That is an arbitrary definition, which you have put forth. And it's obviously false. Because let's say, for example, somebody had all four limbs chopped off, and somebody came forward and said, okay, in the name of Jesus Christ, be healed, and put their hand on them. Science could discover what happened if such a miracle occurred. They could test the limbs. They could see that they were amputated before. They were necrotic. They were atrophying. They were dead cells. And now their arms and legs are working. You could test it. Absolutely you could. You could test for a miracle claim if it happened. The same thing is at work here. What I'm saying is this. Theism is precluded or counted out by definition rather than by allowing the evidence to point where it may. Theism doesn't disagree with the scientific facts. It disagrees with the interpretation of the facts. We're saying, we're reading the same facts, we're looking at the same evidence, but we're saying, how do you interpret that? It's a philosophical question. And if it's a philosophical question, you can't just say, well, I'm going to create an arbitrary definition so that you can't play. You know what they call that? Heads I win, tails you lose. You ever play that with your dad when he had to do chores? Okay, yeah, let's flip for it. Heads I win, tails you lose. I did my chores every time. This naturalistic bias could distort the truth. If you are just assuming naturalism, if you're assuming it a priori, I haven't investigated yet, I'm just going to make the assumption naturalism is true, then you could look at the facts all day long. You could make the you could discover 200 more areas of fine-tuning that are trillions upon trillions of improbability. You could discover it all day long. And yet if you've already assumed naturalism, you could write off all of that evidence right from the start. Let me give you an example. You're a detective. You're in the most, there's racial tension like crazy. Whites hate blacks. Blacks hate whites. And you're a white detective. And you show up on the scene and there's a young white woman who's been raped and killed. Your commissioner comes up behind you and he taps you on the shoulder and he says, all right, McTaggart, which is your name, Detective McTaggart. All right, McTaggart, let's go out and find this son of a gun. You're like, yeah, boss, all right, let's do it. And then he says, but before you do, let's just make sure that he's black. Well, if your commissioner said that to you, the obvious question would come to mind. what happens if the killer wasn't black? So you go out on the scene and you come across the best black suspect you can find. Let's just call him Denzel Washington, just to pull a name out of thin air, okay? And then you start to discover more, and you find the best white suspect out there. And this guy is weird, man. I mean, he's creepy looking, bug-eyed, pale, buck teeth. Let's just call him Steve Buscemi, all right? And so you start to pull out your forensic evidence and the fingerprint evidence. You know, a murder weapon. He's got it at his house, the same caliber. It's got his fingerprints on it. A blast test was done. Gunpowder on his hand at the time of the murder. You start to do DNA evidence. Who's it go to? Steve Buscemi. Eyewitness testimony. They say we saw a guy. He was just funny looking. 5'8", buck tooth, bug eyed, kind of looks like a serial killer. You know what I mean? All of the evidence seems to point to Steve Buscemi. But here's the question. Given the previously assumed racial bias, who is going to get convicted for the crime? Is it true that in this made-up illustration, Denzel Washington is the most likely suspect if you're only looking at African Americans? Yeah, that is true. What turns out is, yeah, you have found the best black suspect, but you've missed the real suspect. You could say the best naturalistic explanation is X, Y, or Z, but that's not really the question. We don't want to know what the best naturalistic explanation is. We want to know what the true explanation is. And if you have a previously assumed naturalistic bias, you don't have, well, you don't have theism at your disposal to be able to show, well, maybe we're seeing something which is designed or created by God. The concept of design, or looking for intelligence, or looking for information, this is a viable explanation. People will say, well, you're making a statement of ignorance. You don't know what caused it, and so therefore you're saying intelligence caused it. Absolutely false. That is absolutely false. Every single day, probably 10,000 times a day, you are able to distinguish between natural causes and intelligent causes. When you see something written up on the whiteboard, when you read an email, when you see a poster in the sky, when you see tire tracks, when you look at a garden, when you look at specific areas of life, you can tell whether that was naturally caused or whether that was an intelligent cause. Why? Because minds always produce information. Complexity could come from natural causes, i.e., or e.g., a snowflake. A snowflake is very complex, but a snowflake doesn't contain information. Because we can recognize information in the present, we can distinguish between intelligent causes and natural causes, we should be able to do this in the past as well. As we review the literature as well, we see that it's not just that Christians can recognize design, atheists can too. This is an intuition. In fact, Richard Dawkins, page one, this is the doorway into his book, The Blind Watchmaker. This is the first page. He says, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. It's not just that we're looking out at the world and saying, well, I think there's some design there. It's that Richard Dawkins is seeing the same thing. He's just saying the explanation for it is a natural cause. Now, could he be right? If it happened that we could explain a certain event or a phenomenon through a natural cause, would we agree with him? Absolutely. The question is, are natural causes sufficient for showing that such a thing could happen? Michael Shermer, founder of Skeptic Magazine, he says the design inference comes naturally. The reason people think that a designer created the world is because it looks designed. I think we should quit tiptoeing around this inference and admit that life looks designed because it was, from the bottom up, by evolution. Now, if it could be shown that natural causes could explain all of these different phenomena which we see, I would be inclined to say it was a natural cause. For example, star formation. Yeah, gravity, mass, energy coming together. Yeah, if it can be explained that way, absolutely. The question is it sufficient in and of itself? Information always comes from an intelligent cause. We can't cite a single example where information came from an unintelligent cause. You have examples where you have the same repetition of letters, you know, M-O-M, M-O-M, M-O-M. But we never have an example where information can come from a non-intelligent cause. They'll cite examples like snowflakes. Yeah, those are complex, but they don't contain information. When we approach the fine-tuning of the universe, what we see there is not just complexity, but a specified complexity. It's complex and improbable, but it also fits an independent pattern. So it's not just like a kid going to a piano and banging out a bunch of notes pell-mell. It's a kid sitting down and playing Bach or Beethoven. It's not just improbable, but it fits an independent pattern, and that's what we have here. So in other words, we're not basing this view on what we don't know. We're basing this on what we do know, that information always comes from an intelligent cause. Also, let me just point out real quick, negative evidence is good evidence. Negative evidence is good evidence. They'll say something like this, well, you're just showing how natural causes couldn't have explained it. But just because you've shown that doesn't mean that you've proven an intelligent cause or God, let's say. That's not true. Imagine if you're on the phone with somebody and you're like, hey man, how you doing? Good. Where are you at? I'm on Mars. Mars? Is that like a new, is that like a bar? What is that? No, planet Mars, like fourth planet from the sun. I'm on Mars. You're on Mars. And we're having a conversation. Really. And we're talking on my cell phone. Wow. I would have thought that would take like, you know, 15 minutes for the signal to get to you. And then you, and I don't even know humans made it to Mars yet. I don't think we have the technology to do that. I don't think we've seen the mechanisms possible to get you to Mars and so on and so forth. If you could pile up negative evidence after negative evidence after negative evidence, you wouldn't have to know where your friend was. You wouldn't have to know if he was down the street or down at school, but you could know for sure that can't be the cause. And so another cause needs to be in play. The same thing is true with materialistic causes. If we could show that that's not an adequate mechanism to explain it, it really asks us the question, well, what did cause it? When we think about the concept of information, so this could be applied in many different areas of teleology or design, fine-tuning, origin of life, so on and so forth. Scientists use this methodology in various different fields. For example, cryptography. Scientists are able to study, really mathematicians are able to study, the difference between a random code, a random signal, and a signal that has a message embedded in it. Just think of the Americans and the Germans during World War II, where they were constantly encoding their transmissions, and code breakers were trying to break them. They had to be able to discern if this is just a random line of code or if there's actually meaning behind it. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. You know what they're measuring? They're not trying to get a picture of ET. What they're doing is they're collecting radio waves and any other sort of information that would come from the universe of an alien civilization trying to make contact. In fact, did you ever see that movie Contact with Jodie Foster? 1997, a Carl Sagan book made into a movie. In the film, Jodie Foster's character works for SETI, and she's just listening to radio programs over and over and over. And it's just static. It's just junk. There's nothing coming through until she gets the first 20 prime numbers that come through. The first 20 prime numbers. And in the film, when the first 20 prime numbers come through, Jodie Foster's face lights up, and she said, we've done it. There must be an intelligent source on the other end of the line, so to speak. Now, if she's able to identify intelligence from the first 20 prime numbers, what happens when we're looking at the encyclopedic code of the human genome, or DNA in general? That there's a message in here that if any one part of it was moved or broken, it would result in fatality. Richard Dawkins was the one who said in The Blind Watchmaker that even the simplest cell contains enough encyclopedias to fill a library. Maybe it was 20 sets of encyclopedias, something like that. So it's the same process. Forensic science, same thing. You have to be able to discern between natural causes and intelligent causes. J. Warner Wallace was a cold case homicide detective, and he's written two books, which are fantastic. Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene is the second one. In the books, he talks about, as a cold case investigator, he would come into a crime scene and he'd see a body. And he said there was only four causes: accidental, natural, suicide, or homicide. So they'd look at the body and all four causes were in view. It could be accidental. It could be that he kept his bowling ball collection on the top shelf. The ball hit him, knocked him out, killed him. Could have been an accident. It could have been natural. He had a heart attack. God, even a lightning bolt came through the window, killed him. A tree fell. Natural. It could be suicide. It could be self-caused. Or it could be homicide. And he says when you come on a scene, you have to be able to discern which was it. Which type of cause was it? And forensic scientists and detectives do this regularly. So why is it that when we switch fields into the realm of biology, oh, this is just completely ridiculous and we couldn't even imagine that you could discern intelligence? Archaeology, same thing. You're Indiana Jones. You're walking through the Fertile Crescent, the ancient Near East. I don't know. You're going through some kind of a site in the jungle or the forest or the desert or wherever. You come across a stone. Archaeologists have to be able to discern, was this man-made or is this from erosion? Was it intelligence that made this or was it natural causes which made this? If you came across a whole ancient city of pottery and books and houses and structures, you would know this wasn't from erosion. This wasn't from a flood. Intelligence produced this. Another field would be intellectual property protection. Why is it that when Vanilla Ice wrote his song Ice Ice Baby with the bass line dung 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 da da dung 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 da da dung dung, that Queen, the band, could sue him for that? Because he was taking their intellectual property. He stole their bass line and he thought he could just lift it and take it and put it into his song. And Freddie Mercury and Brian May came forward and said, no, you stole that from us. We can tell the difference between an accidental similarity and an intentional, intelligent similarity. When you type out word for word the exact essay of your roommate in a college class and he brings both of those together, you couldn't say it was an accident that that happened. So, finally, theism doesn't stop science. It doesn't stop science. I know some people will say, well, if you're going to start allowing God to enter into the natural world, then the door is going to be open and you'll never be able to shut it. All of a sudden you're going to get New Agers and occult worshipers and we're going to have demons behind every door and goblins under every rock and stone. All of a sudden we're going to have unicorns caused it. All of a sudden we're going to have fairies. We're going to have Tinkerbell. Okay, wait a minute. Theism doesn't stop science. Here's why. Because a miracle, by definition, has to be rare, right? I remember somebody talking to John Lennox about that. He said, well, if a miracle happened, it must have been rare. And he says, indeed. Indeed. Miracles have to be rare by definition. When we think about the material universe and studying it, we have the regularities that occur. Objects fall to the earth. Lab tests can be done. You can have the same predictability over and over and over and over. Regularities are the norm. Singularities are the exception. When we talk about miracles, like the miracle of creation or the miracle of the resurrection or the miracle of whatever, those are extraordinary exceptions. They're not the regular rule. You could still put on your lab coat and with full intellectual integrity, go in and do your study. You wouldn't have to leave God at the door. You would know if I test this, these are regularities. They're not singularities or exceptions. Norman Geisler, the philosopher, in his work on this, differentiates between forensic science and empirical science. Empirical science, says Geisler, is what we practice every day, running experiments, running tests, making hypotheses, testing it in the lab, verifying it, making theories, so on and so forth. Forensic science is not this way. You can't run a test on the Big Bang. You can't go back and say, well, let's do another one. We missed it. You can't do a test on the fine-tuning of the universe, right? You can't do a test on the origin of life. You weren't there. You didn't see it. What we're trying to do here is forensic science. In other words, I believe that it is testable in a sense. You can explore it. You can study it. But it's not the same as empirical science. Empirical science is untouched by the concept of the miraculous. Only forensic science would be affected by this. And even with forensic science, we've already made a case that you could determine between intelligent and unintelligent cause, material causes. To put this really simply, if you're like, okay, I'm kind of getting lost a little bit, here's maybe a nugget you could grapple onto here. Atheists believe in the uniformity of cause and effect in a closed system. The uniformity. It's uniform. There's a certain decorum, order, and it's cause and effect in a closed system. There's nothing that could come in from the outside to muddle with the realm of cause and effect. Theists, specifically biblical theists, Christian theists, believe in the same thing. They just believe it's an open system. So in other words, God created his universe, the universe exists, and yet he is free to intervene in miraculous ways. Also, when we look at the history of science, do you know who were the men and women who launched science forward the most? Bible-believing Christians. Did you know that Isaac Newton, he's rated on Wikipedia, whatever that's worth, as the third most influential man in human history, Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton had a commentary, which you can read, on the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. Okay? This wasn't like I kind of go to church once in a while. I kind of believe in God. I'm really a deist. No, he believed in the miraculous. He believed in predictive prophecy. And he was the one who gave us Newtonian physics. I mean, as you go through history, who were the people that launched the whole scientific enterprise forward? They were theists. And so this thought that, well, if we allow miracles or we believe that we could detect, you know, God was working in some way, we're going to throw science out the window. All I can say is that just has not happened. What we see here instead is that the people proliferating science in incredible ways were believers in God. So, let's pause there for questions, for comments. Yeah. Like we can't compare it to another universe, so to speak. It's confusing the realm in which we're detecting design with the thing itself. So they're saying, well, we don't have another universe to compare it to, but that's, whether I see design in this house or in that house, that's really not the issue. It's what I'm observing. The thing itself carries information. So if you look at our universe, if you can see these hallmarks of intelligence or these hallmarks of design, that's really the issue. Yeah. Okay, so what if they just come back and say, well, you're biased too? True. We're all biased. The question with the bias is not whether we're biased. The question is, does the bias preclude us from seeing the truth? But let me give you an example of that. You talk with LeBron James's mother, and you say, Mrs. James, who's the best basketball player in the NBA? She's going to say, my little boy LeBron. He is so good. And you say, Mrs. James, well, that's nice, but aren't you kind of biased in believing that your son, your kid is the best basketball player out there? Aren't you biased? Is she biased? Of course she's biased. Is she right? She's definitely right. So the same thing is true here. The question is, does the bias preclude you from seeing the truth? And what I'm arguing here is that in this case, it would, because you have constricted your possibility or realm of causes so narrowly. How do you know that the cause isn't outside your little circle? For a theist, do we include naturalistic causes? Yes, we do. But we also include supernatural causes. So our bias would cause us to have a broader, a more tolerant approach to what causes can be included. We're not ruling one or the other out. But the skeptic is. They're saying a priori, no, we don't believe in supernatural causes. Yeah. Okay, here's John Lennox's example for this. He says, empirical science could study a Ford motor car. You could look at the combustion, the gasoline, the intake, the valves, the spark plugs, the electricity, the battery. Empirical science could show you how that thing runs. But empirical science could never tell you how that thing came to be. It can test everything about that car with predictability and routine, but it could never answer the question, where did we get the Ford motor car? Unless you appeal to an engineer, unless you appeal to Henry Ford. So forensic science is delving into the question, when we don't have a repeatable event, how is it that we can study and make predictions about what we see? And the truth is, we do it all the time. You can't ask O.J. Simpson, well, go back and kill your wife a second time, right? No, we can't reproduce it. The data is there, and either he's guilty or he's innocent, but we can't reproduce the crime. We have to go back and do forensic science.